Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Lots going on in Washington today, from the Attorney General's testimony before a House committee to the negotiations over the pandemic relief bill. The Republican proposal unveiled yesterday would cost $1 trillion and would reduce extra unemployment benefits and provide legal protections against COVID-related lawsuits for businesses. House Majority Whip James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, joins us now. Congressman, welcome back and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with unemployment. Republicans are proposing to drop the extra weekly payments from $600 to $200, then transitioning to states giving people 70% of what they were being paid before with some flexibility. Is that a deal breaker for Democrats?
Well, it should be. The fact of the matter is, while they are doing that, they are putting in this bill a new tax deduction for business meals. That, to me, demonstrates the difference in us and them. We're trying to take care of people who are going to work every day, essential workers, trying to keep this economy going, trying to keep their families stabilized, while we are putting in this bill a new tax deduction for business meals. That is an incredible demonstration of exactly who and what they are.
Well, the Republicans have said that the Democratic plan, which is much more expensive than their plan, also has things that shouldn't be in a bill like this, including student loan payments for borrowers, money to support beginning farmers and ranchers. They're calling your plan a socialist manifesto. How do you respond to that?
I would ask the American people to take a look at their proposals versus ours. Yes, we are seeking to have relief for student loan debt because we now know that student loan debt now exceeds credit card debt. And these are the children of the families that we are trying to secure. And it is a much better deal, it seems to me, than this big giveaway they're giving to defense contractors. We don't need any new defense programs. What are we putting in all this money for F-35s? For what? That's only to give some contractors federal welfare.
What about the issue of funding for state and local governments, many of which are in very bad shape right now? The Democrats want to give $1 trillion. Their Republicans don't want to give any additional funding. How are you going to find compromise on that issue?
I don't know how that we find compromise, but maybe there should not be a compromise. It seems to me that for us to approve a plan that we know will render a lot of state governments, a lot of local governments, push them into bankruptcy, laying off scores of people who depended upon these places or these entities they use for what little income that they have coming in, and putting $2 billion in here to construct a new FBI building. What is that all about? Except that the new FBI building they want to construct is about two or three blocks from Trump's hotel. This is the most egregious stuff I've ever seen. And I think that what we need to do going forward is to keep these issues before the American public, and they'll begin to see exactly what it is we are fighting against up here.
But in the meantime, some of this aid for people who are unemployed is going to run out within days. What's going to happen? Is it possible that no bill gets passed to help the people who are struggling?
Well, that is a possibility. But it seems to me that if we're going to cram down the American people's throats a big giveaway for business people to get a meal on their dime, that may be something we need to highlight.
Do you think there could be a short-term extension of benefits if there's no big agreement in the next several days?
Yes, I do think so. I would suspect that having a short-term agreement would be better than not having anything at all. But having a long-term agreement that does not take care of them and enhances the fortunes of corporate business people, that to me is a worse position to be in.
Let me just ask you about one other thing that obviously is on the minds of everybody in Washington today, and that is the late Congressman John Lewis. President Trump says he will not pay his respects to Lewis at the Capitol. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that demonstrates once again the smallness of this guy. John Lewis's life was down there, taken away from him on the Edmund Pettus Bridge at a time when only 2% of the African Americans in Alabama were registered to vote. He was trying to get the vote for black people in Alabama and was met by a mob of police officers. This president is demonstrating once again with sending stormtroopers into Portland and other cities. He's doing the same thing today that John Lewis fought against in Selma, Alabama. And many of us stood with John. John and I were in SNCC together. We were founding members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And we did so because we wanted the right to vote. We wanted to get off the back of buses. We wanted to get rid of the Confederacy. This guy is sending stormtroopers into town or city after city now, trying to reinstate the Confederacy. That is the contrast. So his not showing up to give honor to John Lewis is very understandable to me. John stood for everything he does not stand for and against everything that he does stand for.
That is House Democratic Whip James Clyburn of South Carolina. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, on Capitol Hill, Attorney General William Barr is being grilled by Democrats who accuse him of diverting federal resources to help the president get reelected by sending federal agents into Washington, D.C. and other American cities to crack down on racial justice protesters. Barr is vociferously denying that. We're going to have more on the hearings, but they're somewhat overshadowing another controversy over the president's stand on COVID-19. Last night, President Trump retweeted a video of a doctor saying falsely that masks and lockdowns aren't needed to stop the coronavirus pandemic, that the drug Trump has promoted but scientists decry, hydroxychloroquine, will cure COVID-19. No need for anybody to get sick. The video was considered misinformation by social media sites like Twitter, which removed the president's retweets. Let's briefly bring in ABC political director Rick Klein. And Rick, yesterday in scripted remarks, the president said Americans should wear a mask whenever possible. Last night, he retweets this nonsense and writes something like, interesting narrative. Why would he do that?
Yeah, forget Trump versus Fauci. It's Trump versus Trump. He consistently undercuts his own best instincts and the advice of people around him. This is just days after he seemed to take a totally different tone with his approach to coronavirus, bringing back the briefings, warning people that there's a long road ahead, finally donning a mask. Now the contradictory messaging is everywhere. And it does elevate things we've seen on the fringes of the right wing, suggesting that Dr. Fauci is in league with the Democrats somehow to swing the election to make the president look bad, suggesting that there's a deep state cover-up of potential cures here, that everything's designed to make the president look bad. He likes to play with those forces, even while maintaining publicly that he is following the advice of medical professionals. And it would appear to be undercutting the new narrative, which is that we have to take this seriously.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned forget Trump versus Fauci, but we can't, because he also retweeted someone else last night saying that Anthony Fauci was a fraud who misled the public. On ABC's Good Morning America, Fauci was asked if he could continue to do his job.
This is what I do. This is what I've been trained for my entire professional life, and I'll continue to do it.
To the charge you've been misleading the American public?
I have not been misleading the American public under any circumstances.
As if he should, you know, have to defend that. Look, Rick, this comes as the U.S. has some of the worst metrics in the world on COVID-19. States like Florida, Texas, Arizona, you know, just pummeled by it. Polls show a majority of Americans believe in masks, don't think the president is handling this well. Again, it just doesn't make any sense to attack the man that people think he should be tying himself to.
Yeah, we can look for political or policy motivations here and keep looking, because this isn't the advice the president's getting. This isn't what his fellow Republicans largely want him to say or do. The president has said in the past that he wants to be a cheerleader. That's why he's been hyping hydroxychloroquine. I suppose that's why he might say that the people like Dr. Fauci are pessimists here. But reality's caught up with him. And that's what's stunning about this, is that it seemed to be with the cancellation of his convention, with his reversal on schools, with his support of masks, that the president was acknowledging this reality, that we had to get serious about this, otherwise it would continue to spiral out of control. For him to continue to undercut his own messaging on that, I think it's damaging to public health. It's damaging to his own political standing. Perhaps it plays to a hardcore base that wants to believe in conspiracy theories, but I don't see it in any way, shape, or form as a productive message.
We also were hearing today that the president made up that story about throwing out the first pitch at a Yankees game because he was so angry that Dr. Fauci threw out the first pitch at a Washington Nationals game. But, you know, about 30 seconds left here, Rick. What is the plan till Election Day?
It is to try to change the conversation to Joe Biden. And the only way that the president can succeed is if COVID gets better, if there's an economic recovery, and if this becomes a choice and not a referendum.
Yeah. Rick Klein, political director at ABC. Thank you. One of the most extraordinary people in American history is getting a new spotlight. You may have heard the words of Frederick Douglass this past 4th of July. An escaped slave, he then very publicly and eloquently led the fight against slavery, traveling in some of the finest circles, captivating with his oratory. Here is James Earl Jones reading part of Frederick Douglass's What to the Slave is the 4th of July, delivered in 1852, called the most damning critique of American hypocrisy ever.
Prosperity and independence, bequeathed by your fathers, is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty, and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today?
Now, the most important collection of Frederick Douglass artifacts, including drafts of this speech and family scrapbooks of letters and photographs, has been acquired by Yale's Beinecke Library and will be available to the public. We wanted to know more about the man who collected these things, retired Georgia surgeon Walter O. Evans. His Douglass scrapbooks, now Yale, formed the basis for historian David Blight's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, soon to be a Netflix movie produced by Barack and Michelle Obama's production company. And Dr. Walter Evans joins us by Skype from Savannah. Dr. Evans, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to hear a little about you. If you don't mind, I'm going to do a synopsis here. Your dad died way too young in a car accident. You were just 9. Your mom moved the family from the South to Connecticut. You became one of the few blacks in a school there, seemed to have an impact on you. You then followed siblings into the military, then went to Howard University, pivoted into medicine, full scholarships to medical schools, eventually chief of surgery at Hutzel Hospital in Detroit. When did you realize along the way there that you had also a love for collecting?
I was introduced to art and literature when I was in the Navy. I was transferred to the U.S. Naval Hospital, and I met a young lady, and she wanted to go to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I had never been in an art museum in my life, and I went to the library to read about what we were going to be seeing there, and she was duly impressed, which is what I wanted to do. I started reading more to impress her, but I had not a penny to spend until many years later when I started my practice, and immediately I started to collect not just art, but also books and manuscripts and letters.
Sounds like there were some Hosanna moments there. The Philadelphia Museum of Art will do that to you. Bring us to Frederick Douglass, an escaped slave who became an acclaimed orator, the most photographed man in America in the 1800s. What did he mean to you? Was there something specific about Frederick Douglass, or did you just happen to come across his papers?
Both. Frederick Douglass, as you mentioned, was an outsized character, one of the most important people in America to this day, really. But I had been collecting a while when I came across a great amount of these papers, the first batch of them. And the dealer really wanted them to go to an institution, but the institutions weren't interested at that point. So I purchased them. Normally, most of these dealers who dealt in antiquarian African-American books and manuscripts and letters and things, they would call me. This was in the 1980s, and I started collecting in the mid-1970s. But this time, he didn't call me. And when I got the catalog, I jumped right on it because I thought somebody else might see them. And they hadn't, so I bought the first batch, and about a year later, the second batch, and a few other things along the way.
Well, you answer my question, because I'm thinking when I was first reading that, you know, somebody had passed these papers on to Yale, I'm thinking, just now? You know, and you have an answer there that an institution didn't immediately jump on them is, I'm sure they're all, you know, having meetings questioning that. But you knew what this was. When you first are opening a scrapbook that Frederick Douglass's family put together, when you're first seeing these materials, what's that like for you?
Well, let me just tell you this. The first thing, it came in boxes and boxes, many, many boxes. And first thing I had to do is to have them restored. And then I had archival cases made, many archival cases. They're at Yale right now. So that's the first thing I did. But the clippings in the scrapbooks, they were voluminous. It wasn't until later that one of the first scholars, no, the first scholar to really pay attention to this, David Blight, he started looking at this material and was overwhelmed. Now, I don't even know if he's read everything. So, I was thrilled to have this, but I'm a collector now. And once you're satisfied with a certain item, you go on to the next item, and then again and again. It's an addiction. So you have this, then you go on, you continue to chase to the next item.
Well, you have to get artifacts from the author Zora Neale Hurston. You have to get the drawings of the 20th century African-American political cartoonist Oliver Wendell Harrington. You're just, as you say, addicted. But this is your heritage, your past as an African-American. Tell us more about that. What are you trying to do in amassing it? What does it feel like to find these things?
Well, I would never separate these papers. I want it to be together because even before David Blight came, I opened up my house to art historians. I wanted to share this material because what Frederick Douglass was about, it's the same thing happening in America today. I mean, the problems that he was trying to solve, the struggle, it's still here. Most of this collection is about the latter third of his life. And that we did not know in the autobiographies, and we did not know in the biographies. So I knew that I had something extremely important.
Well, it's kind of warts and all. You know, ascending people were maybe trying to take him down, or members of his family. He, at one point, backed a white candidate for an office because the black candidate had left the Republican Party, if I understand that right, which was very controversial, married a white woman later in life.
That's correct. He had several enemies in the latter part of his life. As you said, that was John Mercer Langston, who was Langston Hughes' uncle, I believe. But he did not back him for Congress. He backed a white man because he felt his ideology was more in tune with his own. But there were so many. I mean, there was jealousies, and then there was the family. All came looking for him, family and quote-unquote family.
What's that like to sit in your home surrounded by, it's almost like the ghosts of these African-Americans you're surrounded by?
Okay, I have several letters that were written by Toussaint Louverture, a Haitian who was responsible for the Haitian Revolution over the French. Yale, about seven, eight years ago, acquired my James Baldwin letters. And at the time, I don't know if this still holds true, but at the time, it was the largest collection known of James Baldwin letters. And I have just about everything that all the books signed, first editions of Zora Neale Hurston, Jesse Fawcett, Ralph Ellison, you name it. I have first edition, and in some cases signed to other important people.
Nice feeling. And a nice feeling, it sounds like, to give it away, to give it to scholars and to the public.
Well, yes. I'll tell you what happened after David Blight came to the house. He would come at least once, sometimes two or three times a year, sit at the table. And he did this for about 12 years. But not only did he come, he told other scholars about it, and they started coming, and they told other people. So it was a pilgrimage to Savannah, and they all sat at the dining room table. Now, I wouldn't stay in there with them. I would check in the evenings. What did you find? Because they found things that I didn't even know was in there. I mean, they're the scholars. I'm the collector.
And by the way, it's also going to be part of the film that the Obama production company is putting together for Netflix. I'm just curious, have you chatted with the Obamas about your collection? Or
I have not, but I have chatted to people who are involved with this, and I told them that I am at the age now, 77, that Frederick Douglass was when he passed, and I would make a grand Frederick Douglass. But I wouldn't mind making a cameo.
Well, you could maybe tell them that, you know, there might be a place at the dining room table if you want to come look at my stuff.
Oh, yes. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I'd love to be in it.
Collector Walter Evans. We'll have some pictures of his artifacts at hereandnow.org. Dr. Evans, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I would like to say one thing. Please, the Beinecke will digitize this collection, and it will be available for the world to see. And the original documents will be there in time for the world to see. And we are having an exhibition that I think will happen within the next 2 years of the Douglass material and some of the other material from the Evans collection, the James Baldwin letters, and the Ollie Harrington cartoons.
In other words, you're saying you want people to come.
Exactly.
Walter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The world's richest man is set to testify before Congress tomorrow for the first time ever. Jeff Bezos is one of four powerful tech CEOs who will face tough questions from the House Antitrust Subcommittee, along with Apple CEO Tim Cook, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google and its parent company, Alphabet. Let's bring in Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent for Recode. Jason, let's start with Bezos. He's got a lot to answer questions about. This will also be the first time he'll have to respond publicly to that damaging report alleging that Amazon uses data it collects from its own merchants to compete against them, which is something the company has told Congress it doesn't do. How big a moment is this going to be for Bezos and Amazon?
I think it's a really important moment. You know, Jeff is a public figure in many ways, but they have really shielded him from difficult interviews in the 7 years I've covered the company. He's never sat for an extended interview with sort of a regular Amazon beat reporter. And so I think this is the closest thing we're going to get to him sort of having to be publicly responsible and provide public on the record comments for some business practices that people just have a lot of questions about.
What do you think he's going to be asked about?
You know, I think there'll be three or four main issues that I'm expecting. One for sure is how Amazon uses data from its own merchants that sell on Amazon to build products to compete against them. Amazon has long said it only uses aggregate data from these sellers about a given product, you know, to inform how they develop their own products. But the Wall Street Journal published a report interviewing former employees saying, you know, actually, we've looked at an individual seller's product and made informed decisions based off of just that. So that for sure will be a topic. Amazon also has been accused of favoring itself and its own business needs ahead of its own merchants in other ways, by how it decides who wins a certain sale with a certain customer in real time. That's algorithmic, but there will be questions about that. And then completely separate, I think we'll see questions about counterfeit and stolen goods on Amazon and how it does or doesn't police that well. And we may even get questions related to its treatment of warehouse associates. That is not sort of traditional antitrust issue, but I'm sure you could make an argument that its power gives it sort of this labor power that allows it to treat warehouse workers in certain ways.
Do you expect this hearing will lead to any actions? We've been hearing calls from both parties to break up big tech for some time now. Is that any closer to actually happening?
I don't think we'll see sort of a direct correlation between, you know, this hearing and, you know, near-term action. But what we will see is a couple of things, potentially. Pressure on the regulators like the FTC or the Department of Justice to enforce actions against these companies based on some perhaps evidence or statements. We may also see them come out with a report after this hearing that says, hey, those antitrust laws that we've had on the books for a century, we need to throw them out or really reinvent them because they were created long before these digital platforms sort of modernized and revolutionized the way commerce, media, and entertainment happen online.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we will see some impact. It just may not be as near term as perhaps some critics would hope.
That is Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent for Recode. We'll be watching. It should be very interesting tomorrow. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
The Trump administration's been busy during the pandemic, ramping up efforts to reshape, roll back, or dismantle longstanding environmental regulations on water, air, climate change, including the law considered the foundation of American environmental law, the 50-year-old National Environmental Policy Act. And that's just the tip of this rapidly melting iceberg. According to reporters like Kendra Pierre Lewis, senior reporter for Gimlet Media's How to Save a Planet podcast and author of Greenwashed, Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Green Planet. She joins us from New York to talk about just a few of the more than 100 Trump administration environmental rule rollbacks. Kendra, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're going to probably get to maybe four or five of the most recent regulations that are being dismantled out of nearly 100. Just your sense of what you've been watching over the past 5 months.
So the Trump administration has been undergoing a really big push to sort of push through their deregulatory agenda before the election. And one thing I really want to make clear to your listeners is the position where we are right now, which is it's been an unusually hot summer. We've had 8 hurricanes, and there's a really strong chance that we're about to have our 9th named storm. So I just kind of want to put this in a broader context of what these regulations mean in terms of where our planet is. These rules have real life repercussions.
Well, we've been hearing people involved in the climate change movement feeling like they're watching helplessly from the sidelines of a pandemic, saying, hey, we're next, you know, we're going to be coming on stage soon, and things are only getting worse when it comes to climate change. But people have been more focused, of course, on the pandemic, and, you know, many people say they're connected. So let's talk about the biggest change, the National Environmental Policy Act. This is what created the review process, you know, before you could build infrastructure, you know, highways, energy plants. You had to have a review of its impact on the environment. What does the rollback, the change, do?
Yeah, so the rollback does a few things. First, it narrows the scope of the number of projects that are considered that have to go through this environmental review process. And one thing to be really clear about is the vast majority of federal projects don't actually have to go through this kind of intense environmental review. It's something like 1% actually do. And that environmental review process simply makes you consider the alternatives so that you realize maybe we don't have to build this highway through a protected habitat. We can build this highway sort of around the protected habitat. The new rule says that even fewer of those projects have to go through that process. The other thing that it does is that even when a project has to go through that process, you don't have to consider climate as one of the potential environmental impact, which many people are interpreting as a giveaway to pipelines, because pipelines have a really large climate effect on top of their broader environmental footprint.
Yeah. And not only would fewer projects have to consider climate in a review process, they don't have as much time to consider it. The environmental impact studies would have to be 1 to 2 years, which, you know, many people doing these projects say that's not possible. The president says, you know, any longer is too much red tape. Democrats are saying they're going to fight this, but it feels like it's a fait accompli.
I mean, it's technically a finalized rule. So the thing that's happened, I think, that a lot of people don't fully understand kind of over the past 50, 60 years, is that basically once we started cleaning our air and water, we realize that clean air and water were actually good things. And so there are lots of broader requirements. And one place where you sort of see this playing out is under the Trump administration's rollback of like the Clean Power Plan, which was designed to reduce emissions from coal-powered plants and utilities. That original rule that the Obama administration created actually came out of a lawsuit, which said that the EPA had to regulate carbon emissions, right? So now the Trump administration's plan, it doesn't go as far as the Obama administration plan. And there was some question as to whether or not the Obama administration's plan went far enough. So some of these rules that are getting rolled back, there is strong legal challenges that might undo them down the line.
And also, there might be something else I'm wondering that might undo this down the line, which is the election. I mean, can right. these changes being made by the Trump administration be changed again by another administration?
Yes. So, yes, it's a short answer. You know, a lot of these have gone through the proper process, which is different because in the beginning of the Trump administration, the administration was sort of creating legislation by fiat, and they didn't go through this kind of introduce or propose a regulation, open it up to public comment, review the regulation, and then pass the final regulation process. They weren't doing that at first at all in the beginning, and so they were getting sued a lot and being forced to undo things just because they didn't follow the process, which is regulated. And now they follow the process. So you can undo these by following the regulatory process. But again, it depends on what the composition of Congress is. And we're running out of time. Even if there was a change in administration that wanted more environmental regulations, every day that we don't reduce carbon emissions is a problem. Every additional unit of carbon that's emitted into the atmosphere is a problem. And so, yes, we can undo these rules, but I also caution the fact that we're running out of time. And a new study came out pretty recently that we may have less time than we even thought, that the best case scenario we've been aspiring towards might not be feasible.
Well, okay, let's plow on through these other changes that have happened. The General Accounting Office recently released a report that lowballs the cost of damages done by greenhouse gas emissions. We know every ton of CO2 released has an economic impact, things like, you know, damaged infrastructure, sea level rise, weather events. And the new accounting is 7 times lower than under the Obama administration's accounting, which set the social cost of carbon at about $82 a ton. The Trump administration says it's about $11. So completely lowballing the cost and charging less for the cost.
Yeah. So basically everyone who does this for a living agrees that the Trump administration's costs are too low. I mean, it's a question mark of how do you price carbon, but we know we've had some of the most expensive disaster years on record, and they're completely tied to climate change. So Hurricane Harvey, for example, 40% of that rainfall that was disastrous in Houston and sort of that broader region is because of climate change. And so it's really difficult to have billion-dollar disaster year after billion-dollar disaster year and not acknowledge that there's a real human and economic cost associated with that.
Fuel economy standards. There was a rollback in early April of the Obama-era standards. The Trump administration says it will make cars cheaper, which is better for the economy. But analysts say cheaper cars using more gas is actually more expensive over the lifetime of a car. Putting that aside, what does this mean for carbon dioxide emissions?
Yeah, nothing good. So the Obama administration wanted to get the fleet-wide average to 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. And the Trump administration has dropped that to about 40 miles per gallon. You're right that the administration says that it will be cheaper. They also are arguing that because cars will be cheaper, people with old cars will buy newer cars that have higher safety standards, and that will save lives. But the thing that they're not factoring into that assessment is the number of lives that climate change will claim. And we know that it'll release about 1 billion more tons of carbon dioxide, this changing of the rules, as well as burn 80 billion more gallons of gas. So it's not great from a carbon perspective. And as I want to reiterate, climate change has a cost. We're in the middle of a heat wave right now in a lot of the country. Like, this has just been a very hot summer, and we know that's climate change.
We also had an EPA proposal in June to overhaul clean air rules. You mentioned clean air. Based on an accounting technique, changing the cost-benefit analysis, from now on only weighing the economic impact of a proposed rule, not the, you know, harder to find costs to public health. This is an EPA head by an industry, a former industry guy, Andrew Wheeler. You know, we're just touching on just a few of the changes that have been made.
I think it's also just worth pointing out that as a condition of the pandemic, that the Trump administration sort of decided not to continue enforcing. Basically, if you're a polluter, if you're an electric facility or something, and you emit a certain amount of pollution and you emit over your tolerable level, you have to report. And the Trump administration said, because of the pandemic, that these facilities no longer had to report when they had excess pollution events, right? So we're talking about facilities that emit air pollution in the middle of a pandemic that we know causes respiratory distress, and we know that pollution makes respiratory illnesses worse. In fact, there's research that suggests that people who've had higher levels of exposure to pollution over the course of their life are more likely to die of the coronavirus. There's this mismatch in terms of what we're valuing, right? And that's only exacerbated by these kinds of regulatory changes. It's essentially prioritizing the interests of corporations over the interests of the people who live in this country.
At one of the toughest times in this country. Kendra Pierre Lewis, author, climate reporter for the Gimlet Podcast Company. Kendra, we've just touched on the surface of this, but thank you so much for helping us do that.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
North Carolina is now in the top 10, and that is not a good thing. Top 10 in terms of the most coronavirus cases of any state, and top 10 in terms of the most new cases in the last couple days. Let's find out what's going on there with Jason DeBruin, who's a reporter with WUNC. He joins us from Raleigh. Jason, tell us about the spike in cases that you're seeing there right now.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it is jumping up. You know, now we're measuring new cases in the hundreds and some days even the thousands as opposed to the dozens, which is a little bit concerning, obviously. One thing that's maybe not quite as concerning is that our hospitalizations do seem to have plateaued a little bit. For many weeks, we were sort of going up and up, slow and steady, not any big spikes, but definitely seeing day-over-day increases and certainly week-over-week increases. Now here for the past week or so, those hospitalizations do seem to have leveled off. Of course, you know, there's always maybe that week or even sometimes 2 week lag period when you talk about a lab confirmed case to a hospitalization. Mm-hmm. So we're cautiously optimistic about the hospitalization number, but certainly our health experts are looking at that, you know, lab confirmed cases number and are worried that our hospitals might see another uptick here in, well, really the next couple of days, but into the next week as well.
And I know that you've noticed that there are also a lot of cases focused in meatpacking plants, which is something we've also seen in other states.
Absolutely. Look, as you know, it's sort of a good environment for the virus to flow, right? I mean, it's cold. People are close to each other, having to shout at each other because of the noise. You might not know this, but North Carolina is actually the second largest hog-producing state. We're behind Iowa, so it's a major driver of our economy. Thousands of workers in that industry. And of course, President Trump many months ago named these essential workers, and certainly they are, right? I mean, we rely on these meat processing facilities to get not only hot dogs and pork, but also poultry out to our dinner tables. And so certainly mm-hmm. they're important. But yeah, we are seeing outbreaks in these meat processing facilities, unfortunately. And of course, that's also oftentimes an immigrant community, in some cases, people who don't speak much English. And so there is a difficulty in getting some education out to these people, unfortunately, at times.
And in some cases, people who live in multi-generational households, which is also a problem when it comes to spreading the coronavirus. Now, North Carolina is also a research hub. President Trump was there yesterday visiting a lab. What's going on with vaccine development efforts there?
Yeah, so we, that's right. So the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Duke University, I mean, we are pride ourselves here in the Research Triangle Park in our biomedical research. And in fact, UNC Hospitals is going to be one of the sites to do vaccine clinical trials. And so people in this area are perhaps excited to do their part, to sign up for the so-called healthy trials where, you know, first they see if the vaccine does no harm to healthy individuals. So yeah, it should be pretty cool to watch that vaccine development right here in our backyard.
Are people in North Carolina in general wearing masks as far as you can tell? Are businesses being careful, and are businesses having to shut back down because of the spike?
So the answer is mostly. I think we've seen that across the nation as well, that people are mostly wearing masks. But that's not to say everybody. Certainly, we've had a group here that has called themselves the Reopen NC right? They've had marches, they've had protests. These people often are not wearing masks, and they're demanding that Governor Cooper, a Democrat, reopen much of the state more quickly than he has. But that said, many businesses are following the rules. Many businesses are requiring people to wear face coverings. I might note that bars here are still closed. So while restaurants are open, bars are closed. Of course, that's been a bit of contention among some. But generally speaking, yeah, people are taking it pretty seriously, though unfortunately that is not across the board.
One more thing I want to ask you about. North Carolina is a swing state in this upcoming presidential race. After Trump's visit there yesterday, Vice President Pence will be there tomorrow. There is a governor's race this year. There's a Senate race this year. What is the landscape right now, or how are people feeling about their leaders?
Tense, maybe. This is probably one of the biggest elections North Carolina will have had for decades. In addition to everything that you just mentioned, there's also redistricting on the table in North Carolina. Right, you know, every 10 years is when the legislature redistricts and draws the lines. And you might remember that there was some contention about how those lines were drawn over the past 10 years. So it's a huge election here in North Carolina, probably the biggest in 30 years or more, and perhaps even more than that. So definitely one to keep an eye on. People here are watching it very closely. And I think that nerves are pretty high and will stay high between now and Election Day.
And do you think it's hinging on what happens with the coronavirus?
I don't know that it's hinging on that alone. Certainly there are a lot of other topics, but clearly that is one of the main focuses of this election in North Carolina and other states, right? So I don't know that I would say it hinges on that exactly, but clearly it's a major, major factor.
That is Jason DeBruin, who's a reporter with WUNC, joining us from Raleigh. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.